until September. And we have as our first case 99-0316, State v. Steele. Justice Prosser is not participating. John D. Lemarski, Assistant Public Defender, arguing for Mr. Steele. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Lebarski. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Dennis R. Thiel. Mr. Thiel was committed to institutional care pursuant to Chapter 980 following a trial to the court, the Honorable Peter L. Grimm presiding. Mr. Thiel claims on appeal that the evidence offered in support of his commitment was insufficient. Specifically, he claims that the state failed to provide sufficient proof to show that he was within 90 days of his release or discharge. The issue presented for review was whether the state is required to prove at a trial, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the respondent in a Chapter 980 petition is within 90 days of discharge or release. If this court finds that the state is obligated to provide such proof, then it must decide whether, in this case, the state provided sufficient proof of that fact. And as a corollary, this court must decide whether the defendant may now raise that claim for the first time on appeal. This issue was certified to this court by District 2 of the Court of Appeals in light, I believe, of two footnotes in cases recently decided by this court, State v. Keenitz and State v. Curiel, which suggest that among those elements the state must prove at a trial is the respondent's proximity to his discharge or release.
Now, the state argues that in both cases, particularly Keenitz, that that's just dicta, that it was obviously not necessary for any holding in that case. You disagree with that?
I disagree.
Why do you disagree?
I would concede that the footnotes in those cases were not essential to the holdings of those cases.
They were just reciting what the law was.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying the footnote was just reciting.
You have to wait to decide this case.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, Mike. No. Did you have another? Should I continue? Or did
the court is having their way with me because of the Keenan's case. But go ahead. I'll let you answer.
Okay. Two statutes are at issue in this case, both of which I believe are plainly stated and unambiguous. Section 980.02 provides that a petition pursuant to Chapter 980 shall allege all of the following and includes the predicate offense, the respondent's proximity to his discharge or release, the fact that the respondent has a mental disorder and that he is dangerous because that mental disorder predisposes him to commit acts of sexual violence. Section 980.05 provides that at a trial the state bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt the allegations set forth in the petition. It's the appellant's position that those two statutes could be no more plain. I believe the state claims that those two statutes are ambiguous because in light of the total purpose of the statute, the state claims that Section 980.02 creates different sorts of allegations, allegations that by their nature are more substantive and more complex, allegations, for example, that go to the respondent's mental illness and dangerousness, and also allows for allegations that are more procedural or ministerial in nature. It's the appellant's position that these two statutes are not ambiguous simply because they require the state to prove certain allegations that are more in their nature substantive and some allegations that are more in their nature procedural. For example, there are a number of criminal statutes that contain elements that are largely ministerial or largely procedural, such as the statute that prohibits escape, the statute that prohibits a felon from being in possession of a firearm, or the statute that prohibits battery by a prisoner. the person's status as a prisoner, the person's status as an escapee, or the person's status as a felon in the case of felon in possession of a firearm, are largely ministerial or procedural allegations not susceptible of tremendously complex proof. The state also argues that 980.02 is ambiguous because subsection 3 of that statute provides essentially that the state must set forth sufficient facts in the petition to support probable cause. And the state argues that this is a new category of allegations, essentially allegations of fact. So what the state, I think, is suggesting is that there are three sorts of allegations: substantive allegations, procedural allegations, and what they call allegations of fact, and that it's essentially unclear what it is that the state needs to prove. I think what the state is doing essentially is creating a fiction here, distinguishing between these sorts of allegations. I think a look at the legislative history in this case would support the appellant's position. Legislative history can't be used to show that a statute that's unambiguous on its face is indeed ambiguous. Legislative history certainly can be used to show that a statute that is unambiguous on its face is indeed unambiguous. And I think that a review of the legislative history would show that the statutes in question are indeed unambiguous. I think it's reasonable to assume that the legislature took great care with Chapter 980. It was a controversial procedure from the beginning, and divided people on all sides of the aisle. And in light of that, it seems to me reasonable to think that they took some care in putting this particular statute together and in putting together what it is that the state must prove to secure the person's commitment. Chapter 980 also underwent a number of revisions, one of which is alluded to in my brief. Essentially, adopting the state's position here today that the allegations in the petition need only state that the person is sexually violent, and the proof at trial need only be that the person is a sexually violent person. In a nutshell, the legislature discarded that earlier draft and came up with the draft that's presently law. At the time that the present bill became law, there was a note by the Legislative Reference Bureau essentially saying that the four allegations set forth in the petition are those allegations which must be proven by the state at trial beyond a reasonable doubt. I think it's also important, and I'd like to take time to note, that this 90-day rule, as I'll call it in shorthand, isn't a mere technicality. What the 90-day rule does is enable the state to tell the jury that this person who's subject to the petition is about to get out, that he's within 90 days of his release or discharge, that inferentially everything that the institution has to offer the person is about complete, that the traditional notions of restraint are no longer going to apply to this person, and that this person is soon to be into the community. And I think the legislature very rationally and reasonably decided that this is something that ought to be proven or ought to be put before the jury. I suppose conversely the issue could be raised that if this is not an essential element of proof, then perhaps it's not information that can go to the jury. And certainly, a jury evaluating a person's dangerousness ought to know how close that person is to discharge in order to, in my opinion, effectively gauge that person's dangerousness.
Let me pursue that so that I make sure I understand. It's your position, then, that the 90-day allegation goes to the issue of dangerousness. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Then, in other words, you're saying, look, there are allegations, the person has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, there may be an allegation that the person has a mental disorder, and that there's an allegation of dangerousness. I want to make sure I understand this. So, if there were merely an allegation that he's convicted of sexually violent offense and mental disorder, if he still had 3 years, if he still had 30 years to serve, that it may be logical to conclude that he's not dangerous because he's in confinement.
Correct, and he has the opportunity to take advantage of whatever programs that the institution might offer to curb the person of the particular problem he faces. Correct. I mean, there are other reasons, I think, some of which were stated by the state, for this 90-day rule. It limits the pool of people who can be committed. It directs the resources of the state, the criminal justice system, and the institutions to people who are close to their discharge. But it's a very reasonable and rational choice for the legislature to include the respondent's proximity to discharge as one of those allegations that must be stated in the petition, and also one of those that must be proven at trial. Simply as I've indicated, because it tells the jury, okay, this person is about to be released. He's within 90 days of his discharge or release on supervision, and anything that he's going to get from the institution or from parole supervision is about to end, and he's not going to be confined in the traditional notion of confinement.
Let me just ask you, I really expected you to argue that this is a jurisdictional issue, that you either get him or her within the 90-day period or the state is out. So that if that person is released for 1 hour, can't bring that petition. State court loses jurisdiction over the person. And if you bring it 120 days before release, the court has no jurisdiction to act, not just the state. That you've got statute sets up a window of opportunity. And the state either goes within that window or the state is out and the court has no jurisdiction over that issue. And then it's just a subject matter jurisdiction, as we used to call it, or as we now incompetently call it, competence of the court. And it seems to me that there must be other such, and although I haven't given much thought, but probably could come up with other statutes that are like that, that do fit it in. It may not be time, it may be place where you bring the trial, or and that this is just jurisdictional, you're either in or out, and that this has to be so shown.
Well, I think that the 90-day rule certainly has jurisdictional consequences, but as the statute is written, it appears to me that it's a matter of proof. That the petition has to allege something, and that 980.05 says that the state has the burden of proving those allegations. So I take the position here today that it's an essential element of commitment.
Well, didn't that, picking up on that question, unless I'm mistaken, in this case, there was a trial, there was a hearing, and the findings were that Thiel was within that time period. Isn't that what happened here?
I'm sorry, Judge.
No, go ahead.
There was no finding that he fell within that time period.
But implicitly, there was testimony that so-and-so examined him on the 27th of March, and then which was within the 90 days. Is that
The question and argument raised by the state is that the evidence was sufficient to prove this element, and I take the position that it was not sufficient.
Well, was there testimony or documents?
There was both testimony and documents in this case that the state relies on to suggest that the
evidence... Did somebody testify that he was within X days of release?
No, nobody from the institution. Mr. Thiel testified himself, and I think inferentially the state argues that some of his testimony suggested his release date. There was a document in the form of a letter Mr. Thiel wrote seeking a placement while on parole status that suggested that he was sometime soon to be released. And there were a number of documents, Department of Corrections documents, that in the heading contained a date listed for his mandatory release. Now, there were several documents that referred to his mandatory release, but they were not consistent with one another. In other words, one document referred to a release in March and another document referred to a release in June.
Well, there was no evidence, as far as I know, and you can correct me, that he was not within 90 days of release. What?
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
Are there any analogous situations that you can think of dealing with a time period prior to filing? I mean, we have certainly in the context of Chapter 51, we have time periods that you need to have a probable cause hearing, for instance, within 72 hours, or the final hearing within 14 days, or the court can't proceed. But is there anything analogous to days before a petition can be filed in any area of law that you can?
Well, indeed, in Chapter 980, Your Honor, there are time limits that apply for having a probable cause hearing and for having a trial, and those time limits are set forth in the chapter. What makes this a different scheme is that the statute provides that the allegations have to contain this 90-day of release element. I can't, off the top of my head, think of other criminal statutes that have that kind of time limit as an essential element of the offense. There are, as I indicated earlier, some criminal statutes that have essentially procedural or ministerial elements of proof.
What about traffic cases? I mean, nothing comes to mind, but let's say operating after revocation within a certain period of time, operating after suspension after period of time. Isn't there some time element that's important?
Those statutes, I don't think, have as their elements certain time limits. They have an escalating penalty structure depending on the number of offenses that have occurred.
But that's a good one. You have to prove it.
Pardon me?
They have to be proved. The offenses have to be proved. The time within the offense has to be proved.
I mean, like, for drunk, two offenses within the last 5 years, or three offenses within the last 5 years, that's the kind of thing that I'm looking at. Sometimes you need to show that in order to get a conviction on the next level up.
Correct, but I think that typically that's a matter of penalty and not necessarily a matter for the jury to decide. You know, if it's the second offense within 5 years or the third offense within 10 years, those factors go to penalty, I think, more than what it is that the jury must find.
In this case, it wouldn't make any difference, though. It wasn't proved to either the court or the jury.
That's my position.
I know.
Independent of this case, this court wrote the decisions in Curiel and in Keenitz and indicated in both of those decision footnotes suggesting that the 90-day rule is one allegation that the state must prove at trial. The state has argued that it's dicta in the Court of Appeals, I suggested that while the footnotes themselves were not essential to the holding, they could be viewed as essentially administrative or direction from this court to the lower courts with regard to what it is must be proven. I think regardless of whether, strictly speaking, it's dicta or not dicta, I think they're correct statements of the law. The state seems to be suggesting that on one level the legislature didn't really mean what it said when it said the petitions have to allege certain things and the proof at trial has to be of those allegations. It's also suggesting, I think, that this court didn't really mean what it said when it indicated that proximity to discharge is one of those elements that the state must establish at trial.
What seems to me odd is this. I look at the statute, and it has the two statutes. They're plain meaning. I look at the Legislative Reference Bureau, because if it's ambiguous, I'll go to history, and it's in your favor. I look at reported cases, Curiel, Keenitz, and even Post, that say what you advocate. And yet there's a hesitation of, did they really mean it? You've got a plain meaning, you have a legislative history, you have prior reported cases, so why do I have a hesitation? Yeah, I mean, normally you should win hands down with that kind of a hand, you know, cards in your hand.
I think so, and I suggested that I think that the state is creating this fiction, this red herring in a sense that, well, some of these allegations are procedural, some of them are substantive, and another subsection of that statute talks about statements of fact, so there are really allegations of fact. I don't think it makes a lot of difference what label you attach to the allegations. They are allegations that have to be set forth in the petition and allegations that have to be proven at trial.
How do you respond to me saying, but it just doesn't seem to make sense?
What you may be hung up on.
Meaning the Legislative Reference Bureau, the three cases cited, just doesn't seem to make sense. How do you respond to that? Maybe there's nothing.
I'm not sure there is a response, but you may be hung up on the fact that, you know, it's essentially a ministerial, jurisdictional-looking requirement. But it wasn't written that way, and there was a reasonable and rational way for the legislature to write it the way it did, and those statutes are not ambiguous because it might provide some difficulty for the state, or it might prove a trap for an unwary prosecutor. These are plainly stated statutes that I think should be given their full force and effect. If you've got a nagging notion that something's wrong here, I'm not quite sure how to address it, other than to suggest, look at the plain language of the statute and the support that I've offered and go with that.
But the jury instructions that have been used since the creation of this statute do not submit this issue to the jury.
That's correct.
This was a court trial.
This was a court trial. My position is that the work of the jury instruction committee in this case is simply incorrect.
So we have to redo all these cases?
All of the 980 cases? I suppose that argument could be made, that there are lots of cases out there, and this isn't the only one that raises this issue. That have to be looked at.
We're holding one that raises that issue, aren't we?
That's correct.
At least one. Well, does it have to be retroactive?
Well, I think that if this court holds that the 90-day rule is an essential element of the proof and the proof was insufficient, then certainly all those people whose appeals are pending raising that issue are covered. Quite honestly, I don't know and haven't thought through to whether or not somebody committed who has exhausted their appellate rights can now come back and claim that. I don't know. It's a funny statute in the sense that it's civil and criminal and quasi-criminal, so I don't honestly know whether or not the ruling of this court, if it rules in my favor, will be fully retroactive.
But anyway, you'd want your client covered.
Certainly.
Okay.
The state makes the argument in this case that the state doesn't have to prove this 90-day element. All that they have to do essentially is allege it. And in the absence of a comment or challenge by the respondent, that's sufficient proof. And in my opinion, given the constitutional underpinnings of Chapter 980, what's at stake, not only for the community, certainly, but for the person who's subject to the petition, that something more is required. The statute allows someone the right to remain silent. It provides no opportunity, for example, to plead guilty or not guilty, to admit or deny the facts in the petition or to file some sort of answer. So I don't accept the state's proposition at all. That's necessary in this case simply is for the state to allege that fact.
Thank you, Mr. Lubarsky. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman and Assistant Attorney General Diane Welsh representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. The question in this case is what facts, or if you care to characterize it that way, elements or criterion, does the state have to prove at trial beyond a reasonable doubt in order to obtain a verdict that a person is a sexually violent person and thereby obtain a commitment of that person to the custody of the Department of Health and Social Services as a sexually violent person? The parties disagree on whether the language in two particular subsections, or the interaction of those two subsections alone, requires the state to prove that the person is within 90 days of release or discharge at the time the petition was filed, or whether the statute as a whole does not require the state to prove that. Our view that the statute is ambiguous, I wouldn't quite agree with counsel's characterization of our argument. Our argument is based primarily on two things. One is the fundamental principle that in construing the language in a statute, it is never appropriate to look at isolated language in subsections of the statute alone and to ignore the entire context of where that language appears, what that language does, and the entire statute itself. We have to look at Chapter 980 as a whole. If we look at Chapter 980 as a whole...
Sounds like the plain language is against you, Ms. Wilma.
Well, I don't think the plain language is against us. I just think it's a wrong analysis to do it the way he's doing it. If we get to the isolated language in the subsections, I don't think that it is unambiguous either. 980.02 sets what the petition must allege, and it must allege the three things that form the definition of a sexually violent person in 980.01 sub 7. It must allege the person is within 90 days of discharge or release from a sentence for a sexually violent offense. And in subsection 3, it must state the facts, the particular facts showing probable cause to believe this person is a sexually violent person. Then you look at 980.05 sub 3A, which says at a trial, in these cases, the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt the allegations in the petition. Our contention is that the phrase, the allegations, is itself inherently ambiguous because you have to ask the questions, which allegations? All of the allegations that are talked about in section 980.02, that would include all of the factual allegations regarding his mental disorder, the diagnosis, his prior history, every fact going to show that he has a conviction, that he has a mental disorder, and that he's dangerous. And that's not the way cases are tried, as we all know. In either civil or criminal case, the party bearing the burden of proof is not required to prove every underlying fact. And indeed, some factual allegations may drop out altogether.
What do you want us to read into sub 3? Because sub 2 says, shall allege, and there are four things you shall allege. I take that four things to be allegations. I mean, that's just the way that I see it. When you say, you shall allege four things. Number one is an allegation. Number two is an allegation. Number three is an allegation. Number four is an allegation. I don't think that's radical. Then I go to sub 3, and it says, has the burden of proving the allegations. So you want us to say, but not all of the four allegations. So what meaning do you want us to insert there?
Well, first of all, I don't agree that there are only four allegations in 980.02, because if you look at the entire 980.02, there are five allegations. The three that define who a sexually violent person is, that define a sexually violent person, the 90-day clause, and the allegations of specific fact going to show probable cause. So I wouldn't agree, you know, I mean, I think you have to look at the whole section, and then the question is, which allegations is it most likely the legislature really intended the state to prove?
Are you able to... You're not going to convince me that number two isn't an allegation. I mean, I'm just dug deep into that.
Oh, you know, no, I mean, an allegation. I'm not saying it's not an allegation. I'm saying that when you read the phrase, the allegations in the petition, it begs the question, which allegations?
Yes, that's right. And so you want us to qualify the allegations. So whether you probably don't like my phrase, but you want me to write in there, because then everyone recoils and says, oh my God. Goodness, we're doing this statute. What do you want us to divine that belongs in there? How's that? Is that more palatable? What kind of allegations are you talking about? Because you're not talking about all of the allegations.
Right.
You just told me that. What kind of allegations do you want us to interpret sub 3 to apply to?
I want you to interpret sub 3 to apply to the allegations necessary to prove the person is a sexually violent person as defined by the section of the statute which defines sexually violent person, and that is conviction of a sexually violent offense,
the fact of conviction,
defined mental disorder or mental disorder falling within the statutory definition, and dangerous in that the mental disorder makes it substantially probable that he will engage in acts of sexual violence. The things that make this person a sexually violent person, and that term is then used throughout the entire statute.
Does that mean that you just really want us to read out AG? Because I just ticked it off. A says the person has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, person has been found delinquent, or not found not guilty by reason of mental defect. One of those, right?
Right, yes, and I'm using conviction as shorthand. I mean,
right.
It could be one of the others, right?
Okay, that's sure. Number one. That's under A. Under B has a mental disorder, right? B sub B of the section of the 980.022, right?
Mm-hmm.
And C, that he's dangerous to others. So those are the three, right?
Right.
That you want to say, to interpret, that's a better word than read in.
Yes.
Or add. Approving the allegations necessary to prove sexually violent. So you want them to read A, B, and C. And the only one that you don't want is AG.
And sub 3,
which says
Mr. Thiel ignores, but it also talks about the facts that must be alleged in the petition or stated in the petition, and it specifically uses the word alleges in regards to the sexually motivated offense. So I think what we're asking you to do is say, if the legislature did not intend the state to prove all of the allegations, including each and every factual allegation in the petition, which is not a logical way that we prove cases, the statute, we note, does not say all of the allegations, nor does it say only the allegations in 98802 A, B, C, and A, G. So you're either going to have to read something in or something out, or as we contend, simply construe it to mean, in the context and framework of the entire statute, what is it that the legislature felt the state must prove in order to get a verdict and commit a person as a sexually violent person? And the logic of the answer is, it must prove the things that define a sexually violent person in 981 subsection.
If I were in the legislature, I would have drafted the statute that way. I would have drafted the statute the way the legislature drafted it in Chapter 51, 5120, maybe 13E, which says, the petitioner has the burden of proving all required facts by clear and convincing evidence. And then they refer to the facts as being the facts under 5121A, which include the, I should say sub E does not cross-reference 1A, but 1A says what has to be proven, that the individual is mentally ill under 5121A, that the individual is dangerous, that the evidence and is evidenced by recent acts or omissions of the recency. I mean, so I'm saying, look, in fact, Chapter 51, they chose words that suggests you have to prove the dangerousness, you have to prove recent overt acts, you have to prove mental illness. And they chose that, those words. But when we look at 98802, they didn't choose those words. I mean, when we look at 983, they didn't choose those words. They chose the words, the allegations.
Well, I agree the statute could have been written more clearly. That's why it's ambiguous and why we need to construe it. But I don't think it leads to the conclusion. The fact it could have been written more clearly leads to the conclusion that the legislature intended the state to prove the person was within 90 days of discharge or release on parole at the time the petition was filed, because for several reasons. And one reason is, what's important at the time of trial, which may be quite a long ways from the time the petition was filed, there's 45 days within which to hold trial, but there often are delays to get expert reports. The defense may request delays. There may be interlocutory appeals. Some of the cases where there were appeals on the constitutionality were tried 3 and 4 years later. So the time the petition was filed is of no moment at the time of trial. What's important at trial is, does he suffer the condition that makes him a sexually violent person? At this point in time, does he suffer a mental disorder within the meaning of the statute? And is he dangerous within the meaning of the statute?
Is he dangerous if he's confined in jail he's confined and say he's 350 days away from being released? Does that make him a dangerous person?
He is a dangerous person if his mental disorder makes him a dangerous person, regardless of whether he's confined or not. And we know that for a couple of reasons. One is that people who are confined do commit sexually violent offenses. They commit sexually violent offenses against other prisoners, against staff, and sometimes against victims in the visiting room. So the fact that the person cannot prey upon the public, the general public, doesn't mean he's not dangerous. More sort of less colloquial way of looking at it is, the structure of 980 itself recognizes that you can be a sexually violent person and still be either inside or outside of confinement, because once you're found to be a sexually violent person, you meet the definition in 98801 sub 7, you are committed to the custody of Department of Health and Social Services until you are no longer a sexually violent person.
Counsel, you know, I'm following up what Justice Babich is saying. I liken this a bit to the requirement of recent overt acts of dangerousness in 51. I mean, in 51, you can have someone who's just blatantly mentally ill. And maybe 3 years ago, you know, was destructive of everything. It doesn't do it. You need recent, which has a timeliness to it. It doesn't say within 90 days under the statute. It doesn't say within 120 days. But it is clear it's recent overt acts of dangerousness. Follow up with the line of questioning of Justice Babich. Maybe the 90 days, maybe they could have said, you know, there's a certain temporal nature to recent, temporal nature to obviously 90 days. I mean, is that...
No, I don't think so.
The dangerousness, the immediacy of the dangerousness?
No, I don't think so, because, again, the structure of Chapter 980 itself, once you're committed until you're no longer dangerous, but within that commitment, you may be in either institutional care or supervised release being akin to conditional release under NGI or parole. You're on the streets under supervision, but you still have to be dangerous within the meaning of 980, or your commitment, you'd have to be totally discharged. So it's not the be-all and end-all of dangerousness. Now, it may be relevant to dangerousness in the sense that your opportunity to commit offenses may be greater if you're going to be outside the institution, the prison or not. And in fact, Dr. Doran, in this case, looked at Mr. Thiel and found that the fact that he would be on parole and then would be on probation for 10 years might reduce his likelihood of reoffending because he would have more tight supervision than most people. So it has some relevancy in that sense, but it's not the equivalent of dangerousness. In other words, the timing wouldn't have to be there for you to be dangerous. It can't be and be consistent with the rest of Chapter 980. What makes you dangerous is your mental disorder makes you much more likely than not to commit offenses.
What would happen if the person were within 98 days of discharge?
When the petition was filed?
It says you have to show under the person is within 90 days of discharge or release on parole, blah, 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 blah. Yes. Mm-hmm. What would happen?
Well, I think what might happen is that the subject of the petition might make a motion to dismiss and say, you're filing this too early. I'm not within 90 days yet. I have 8 days to go. Then I think you would have a separate analysis unrelated to whether the state has to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt under these statutory sections that Mr. Thiel's relying on, and that would be whether the legislature intended the time frame for the filing of the petition to be, sometimes the courts use mandatory and directory, sometimes they make mandatory and equivalent with having the competency to exercise jurisdiction over the particular case. That's a separate analysis, and that kind of analysis I think is well outlined in the interest of RRE at 162 with second. It lays that analysis out, and then there's further analysis of that kind of question in Kiwanda F, all of which are cited in a footnote in our brief. But I think that's a very separate analysis, just as the flip side would be a separate analysis. What if the person were already on the street, had been on the street for an hour or a week or a day or a month, and a petition were filed? Then I think you would have to kick into that analysis.
Why isn't that analysis applicable here?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, I don't read Mr. Thiel as saying the state could not proceed against me because I was not within that 90 days. He's simply saying you didn't prove it. We did allege it. So it's not a matter of the petition didn't allege it, in which case I think he would just move to amend the petition. He's not affirmatively claiming I wasn't within the 90 days.
Why does he have to claim that? All he has to claim is you didn't prove it. The burden was on you. You didn't prove it. That's it.
Well, but normally, for example, and I don't think this is the equivalent of a statute of limitations, but it's an analogy that works up to a certain point. Normally, the state isn't required to prove, or the party bringing a lawsuit isn't required to state that the case comes within a certain statute of limitations. that's something that the other party has to challenge. But even once they challenge it as an affirmative defense, you don't prove it at trial to the fact finder beyond
the
reasonable doubt.
Here's the analogy, because this, you know, statute of limitations isn't set forth by the legislature in these words in this statute.
Right, that's why it's not a perfect analogy.
How about this as an analogy? Venue.
Well,
how to allege venue in a complaint. It's not a very juicy issue, usually. And indeed, sometimes the state forgets to prove venue. I mean, it's not like you're contesting it. Isn't that something that has to be proven by the state in a criminal case?
In a criminal case, not in a civil case. In a civil case, if it's not challenged, it's waived. And actually, in a criminal case, if it's not challenged at trial, it can be waived. State versus Wanta held that, relying on earlier cases. So waiver is really a separate issue. It's not venue, because venue talks about the place of trial, not the timing. And
I'm trying to look for something that's analogous that doesn't sound exciting. You know, but 90 days doesn't sound exciting in comparison to if you're convicted of a sexual offense, you know, so mentally. Ill. I mean, that's, you know, this is just...
This is geared at, I mean, I think what you're, well, if I can be so bold as to suggest what I think that you, maybe you're struggling with, what role does this play?
That's
it doesn't
exactly
play
it.
The role of venue. It doesn't play the role of personal jurisdiction, like in long-arm statutes where you have to show the person has a sufficient connection with the state. It's not like any of those other analogies.
It plays, because it seems like you're rendering it to a almost surplusage. It's not really important.
Well, I think the role that it plays is that having defined who a sexually violent person is and how we can incapacitate and offer treatment to them for the protection of the public, the legislature, there's then a separate question, which is when shall these actions be brought? When are we concerned about protecting the public from this person? And I think the legislature chose 90 days before discharge or release for two related reasons. One is they were concerned that we not have to wait until after the person is released to the streets on parole or total discharge, have another victim before we can offer the public protection. So they wanted something that would address the specific population of people, a narrow population who suffer a mental disorder, who make it much more likely than not they will recommit offenses, even though they may be on parole and supervision or may not be. They also wanted to, however, not... I mean, we could have designed a system where we don't have a criminal justice system, a prison at all for sexual offenders. We file a 980 petition after they're arrested or after they're convicted, like the old sex crimes law. The legislature chose not to do this. In this case, they said, no, we'll let the prison system work first. And for many, many people, the prison experience, the treatment, the rehabilitation offered in prison will be sufficient, that we can let the normal course go on. They'll either be on parole or probation from another offense, or they'll max out to discharge. But for this group of people, this mentally disordered, dangerous group of people, if the system doesn't work, if the criminal justice penal system hasn't reduced their risk sufficiently, that we're not willing to subject the public to the risk of further offenses, then we use this process. Now, granted, it wouldn't have to be 90 days. I mean, the person's dangerousness is not going to change, whether they're 2 days before release or 89 or 38 days. It's not the date. It's just a general time frame. And then I think you get into these other questions of, well, if it were truly untimely, if it were filed, he's got 6 more years of a sentence. Why are we filing it now? Well, maybe the state should dismiss the petition and wait till he's near his release date. He's out on the street 3 years, and we suddenly want to do a petition. But that's a separate statutory analysis of whether the time frame is one that the legislature intended is fatal to the petition or fatal to the commitment if it's not followed. And we're not really in that analysis. We could certainly do that analysis, and I'd be happy to do a supplemental brief. We kind of sketched it out in our footnote, but I don't see that as really being here because it's separate from the state having to prove it.
Why doesn't the state just concede this? I mean, what's the big deal here? Tell the district attorney that this is something that they have to prove. I mean, when I was a prosecutor, I used to have to prove that somebody was driving a car under conditions in which it seemed just silly. But I had to do it. Or I had to prove one wheel when it seemed like, gee, everybody knows he did this in Portage County, or this act occurred in Portage County. Why doesn't the state simply say this? You know, I would assume Mr. Thiel can be brought back in under the sexual predator law, do it over again, so you've got Mr. Thiel taken care of, and argue for that this be a prospective ruling only.
Well, if you can do a prospective ruling only, then we don't have any problem with it because it's not going.
Can we do a prospective only?
Well, as I understand, my understanding is complete because I don't fully understand it. My understanding, however,
does Ramos have anything to do with this?
Ramos, you can get rid of, but that's another case. My understanding is twofold. Once that under current law regarding direct appeal, which this is, once you apply the case to the person on direct appeal, you at least have to apply it to all people similarly situated, and that means people in the pipeline. Whether you apply it on collateral review is a different matter. I think there's also an issue, and I'm not quite sure how this plays out in all the various permutations, but there is certainly case law that says when you're interpreting a statute, which is what this is, it's always retroactive in the sense that you're just saying what the statute always meant. You can't be changing the meaning. Of course, if there is a way to say it only applies to future cases, and, you know, frankly, the minute we saw this case, this was the first case in 5 years of sex predator prosecutions that our office and DAs had been doing. I now regret it, but at the time, you know, we relied on the jury instructions, and we were not telling prosecutors, you have to prove this too. In hindsight, we wish we had, because it would be easy to do. But we don't know how many cases we have out there where it was not proved, because based on the jury instructions and our interpretation of the statute and the logic of what would the state have to prove to show he's a sexually violent person, we didn't prove it. Now, in some cases, like Mr. Thiel's case, I think there's enough evidence in the record that you can simply say it's uncontroverted, the dates are in there, he's not challenging it, affirm. In some cases, there will be no documents in the record just because those documents didn't contain the information, or maybe the documents weren't offered. The person testified, the report didn't come in, it's not in there. That's a real concern, particularly in cases where we have had victims testify that we wouldn't want to have to bring them in again. Now, maybe we could just try that one narrow issue, like you would, I assume, in a civil case where it's only the damages part is bad, not the negligence and cause. You just retry that one issue. My fear, however, is that based on other briefs we've seen in other cases raising the same issue, that by couching it as sufficiency of the evidence, the defense will then come back and say, you can't retry because the evidence was insufficient. If that argument were to be made, our argument would be, one, double jeopardy clause doesn't prohibit it because this is a civil proceeding. Res judicata and double jeopardy, neither one prohibit it because we don't have a resolution of this fact against the state. It's simply that nobody ever offered the proof because we didn't know it was an issue that had to be proved. So it should not be barred, but that's lurking out there, that we don't want sex predators 5 years worth to be set free.
This is a civil statute, right?
Yes.
We send cases back for retrial, all the time. When they've failed to prove one element or we think that the evidence was lacking and we give them another chance. Like you said, double jeopardy is not implicated. Is it implicated at all?
Think it's implicated. Principles of res judicata would, I assume, be alleged even in a civil case, but there again, I think you have to have a resolution of the fact, and here we don't have that. So our argument would be that it should not be barred. But your original question way back when was, why aren't we just conceding this? And frankly, the reason is that we're concerned about the past cases. If you tell us, starting today, state, you prove this, put in your documents and have somebody testify, we can do that.
You rely on the jury instruction. And part of the jury instruction says, though certainly it must be established. I don't know what that means. You know,
I don't either.
You know, but let me argue that an interpretation of for what word means that the state has to establish it. The state has to prove it. I mean, I don't think I'm jumping too far by going on. The state has to prove it before trial can go forward. Actually, that sounds to me like a jurisdictional issue. But though certainly the state must establish it. Has the state established this?
Yes. In this particular case, we did, because there's actual evidence in the record. Moreover, I think that
to what burden have you established it?
Well, since it's uncontroverted and we have both documents saying this is his MR date, June, whatever it was, 29th, 20-something.
What's your burden of establishing the 90 days?
Well, that's a good question. I would say if it's something called quasi-jurisdictional, then it's only by a preponderance of the evidence.
Uh-huh.
If you go back to the 9805 argument that was the starting point of this, then we'd have proof beyond reasonable doubt.
So, in reality, I borrow from chapter 51,
right,
that clear, satisfactory, and convincing. And
right,
but
which we can also use.
If what's the state's position? You've indicated you believe that, consistent with the jury instruction, certainly the state must establish it. What's the burden of establishing?
Our position is we allege it in the petition, and if it is not contested before trial or at trial, it is established. Similar to
Where do you find that in 9802, sub 3, at trial on a petition under this chapter, the petitioner has the burden of proving allegations in the petition beyond a reasonable doubt. I assume then it would follow after that. However, as to the 90 days, the state has the burden of proving that allegation by the preponderance of evidence. I mean, where should we read that in?
Well, I think you would do two separate tests. First, you would say you don't have to prove it at trial beyond a reasonable doubt because it's not that allegation in 9805-3A does not include that allegation. Then you would say, what does establish mean? What do you have to do? And relying on things like other sort of jurisdictionally types things like personal jurisdiction. In fact, that you don't even have to allege in the complaint. Why you think you can sue this person in Michigan for whatever, his car accident in Wisconsin. But if he challenges it and says, you can't sue me here, then you have to establish it, but you don't do it at trial. So it's that notion is that we allege it, and if it's not challenged, it's established.
Pete Swellman, where does it say that the respondent here, the defendant here, has to file an answer or make challenges?
There's no particular provision for it, but it certainly is a principle of both civil and criminal law that you have waived the right to argue issues on appeal, the right of review on appeal.
It doesn't even require him to answer.
Right.
It doesn't, and there's nothing here. So I assume that in most cases, if not all, there is no answer, and
right,
that does not mean that in a civil case, or even in a criminal case, well, criminal case is different. In a civil case, if you don't answer, it's admitted.
Right, and we're not saying that as to the underlying allegations.
Only one that you're making a special exception.
Well, no, because we're saying even in a criminal case where you don't answer, you put the state to its proof, but you still have to raise your affirmative defenses. You still have to raise statute of limitations. We believe that if this were a criminal case, and the state didn't prove what you believe is an element under a statutory construction analysis, we would say if you didn't raise it in the trial court and alert the court and the state to that, you don't have an automatic right to appeal that issue. Now, there's no Wisconsin case that I know of that directly talks in those terms, but Lefebvre in his criminal procedure book certainly says even sufficiency of the evidence can be waived if it isn't raised in the trial court. You raise it when the state concludes this case. You have to be specific as to what you think has not been proven, and then at its discretion, the court can open the case and let the state put in its proof. So even in a criminal case where there's no burden of proof on the defendant, he has the right to remain silent and all those things. Certainly defendants have, I mean, even though there's no answer, defendants have challenged these petitions from day one on constitutional grounds, on all kinds of grounds, just by filing motions. So there is nothing to prevent Mr. Thiel or anyone else from filing a motion to dismiss, saying, I wasn't within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Lebarski.
Thank you. I'd like to just touch on a couple of points that the state made and perhaps summarize my argument a little bit here. I don't think there's any real question that Chapter 980 is all about the commitment of sexually violent persons. I don't dispute that, and I don't think there's any real argument about it. But just because it's all about the commitment of sexually violent persons doesn't mean that the legislature can't reasonably and rationally set up a scheme for what must be contained in the pleadings and what must be proven at trial. The state suggests that we're really talking about five allegations, the four allegations that are contained in sub 2 and what they call allegations of fact that are contained in sub 3. And what sub 3 states is that a petition filed under this section shall state with particularity essential facts, essentially in support of probable cause. It doesn't use the word allegations, and it doesn't state anything about additional allegations that must be stated in addition to the ones that are contained in sub 2. So to the extent that there's a difference between the words allegations and statements, subsection 3 doesn't create a new world or a new series of allegations that are required to be contained in the petition. It states essentially what's been the rule in criminal cases for forever anyway, and that is that a criminal complaint has to state facts in support of probable cause. Now, and I agree with Ms. Wellman, the state isn't required to prove at trial all of the facts that it puts in a petition or in a criminal complaint in support of probable cause, but it does have to prove those essential allegations. And in this case, those are contained in sub 2. I don't think, I guess in sum, that the statute really could have been written a whole lot more clearly.
Back to just what you just said right now, so you are essentially agreeing that 980.05 is ambiguous?
No.
To the extent that it uses the word the allegations, because you're saying, of course, the state does not have to prove everything that's in the petition.
Under sub 3, it doesn't state anything at all about allegations. It simply states that a petition has to state facts.
No, I'm not talking about the particularity requirement. I agree with you on that. But I'm talking about the requirement in 980.05, which says that the state of trial must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the allegations in the petition.
Correct. The only allegations that need to be contained in the petitions are set forth in sub 2. Sub 3 doesn't say anything else
right.
about new allegations.
Right. But it sounded to me like you were agreeing that the phrase, the allegations, should not be taken literally and is, in fact, ambiguous and requires construction.
No, just the opposite. I think that the word allegations is unambiguous.
But you wouldn't maintain that the state has to prove every factual allegation that is contained in a petition, because often the diagnosis changes between the probable cause evaluation and the ultimate evaluation that's done for trial, and there are many changes in the facts over the course of these cases. Right?
Correct. I'm not saying, and maybe I've been unclear here, I'm not saying that they have to prove all of the facts stated in support of probable cause. Those aren't the allegations that are essential to a petition under 980. The allegations that are essential to a petition under 980 are stated in sub 2, and those allegations, without a doubt, have to be proven. Now, other facts don't have to be proven because they're not allegations. They're statements. And I think I'm using the word allegations as the legislature intended to use it in a particular meaning. They're not saying that the state under sub 908-980-05-3, that the state has to prove all of the statements contained in the petition. 980-05 says that the state has the burden of proving the allegations in the petition. So if they mean what they say, there's certainly a distinction between allegations and what I would call statements of fact. Was that?
And sub 3 just does not refer to the statement of fact as allegation. The only place
sub 3 in 980-02?
Yes. The only place allegation appears in that 2, 4, 6, 7 lines is if the petition alleges that a sexually violent act, offense or act, that is the basis for the allegation under 2A was an act that was sexually motivated, the petition shall state the grounds on which the offense or act is alleged to be sexually motivated. Got it, 3 places, always referring back to 2A, I think that's right. Is that right?
Correct.
That's your interpretation.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lebrowski.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman and Ms. Welch. That concludes our hearing on 99-0316. And we will move on to Stokely Strong.